From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. If you live in one of the states getting ready for tomorrow's voting blitz, this might have been your weekend. Do some laundry, get a call from a volunteer in a presidential candidate's office, watch the Super Bowl, see a soft-focus, high-concept ad by a candidate, brush your teeth and get ready for bed, and get a pre-recorded message from, you guessed it, a presidential candidate. So will Super Tuesday effectively bring the primaries to a close? NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving gives us a window into one of the biggest days in political history. How you doing?
Hello, Farai. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. You know, we're running full tilt here. So let's start with the Democrats. For months, Senator Clinton had held a comfortable lead over Senator Obama nationally. All caveats about polls in place. What happened to their relative standing?
Hillary Clinton was over 50% in some polls in 2007. And then even in January, even after Barack Obama had shocked her in Iowa, she still maintained a 15 to 20 point lead in most polls taken nationally because Barack Obama had not yet been introduced to much of the country. And it was still kind of a one-sided contest. But over the last couple of weeks, particularly since the South Carolina win really relaunched the Obama momentum, he's been not just creeping up, he's been absolutely climbing up, and he has been taking over more and more states. And as a result, now even the national poll is reflecting that this race is too close to call. It's a statistical dead heat.
Now, explain just a little bit about, I mean, no matter who wins what, is this the end? Is this the end or the middle? Or what, you know, what happens after something like Super Tuesday?
Well, Super Tuesday was not necessarily designed to be the end. It was designed to give some states that had been itching to get into the early part of the calendar an opportunity to do so, and many took the opportunity to do so. It began back 20 years ago when some southern states felt like they weren't getting enough of a say in the nominee, and so around about 1984, they started all having their primaries together. That just grew and grew until now we've got 22 states on the Democratic side, 21 states on the Republican side, all doing it on the same day. And, you know, it's getting down to a question of not just who's won how many states, because states, after all, is not how we do this at the convention. We do it by delegates. And so, of course, the focus is on California, New York, Illinois, Georgia, the big ones voting tomorrow. But all the states have delegates, and all the states give each candidate an opportunity to add to their delegate total. And that's, in the end, the math that really matters.
All right, let's go to Republican math. Senator John McCain is leading in most national polls over Mitt Romney. What about surprises? Do we expect any surprises either in terms of the popular vote or the delegates that will shake out tomorrow for the Republicans?
Well, the one would lead to the other. There are a number of winner-take-all contests, eight of them on the Republican side, where simply by winning the plurality of the Republican popular vote, any candidate can take home all of the delegates. Now, that really makes a difference in a few of these states. For example, John McCain is expected to win rather easily in New York and in New Jersey and in Connecticut, the New York metropolitan area, the people who are just recovering from the Giants' last-minute victory. Now, in New York State alone, that's 98 delegates at stake tomorrow for whoever wins by just one vote. That's a big passel of delegates to get all in one place. And in some other states, if you win in every congressional district, you can take home the lion's share of the delegates from that state. So because the Republican rules do weight the winner more heavily and give extra bonus delegates for just winning, whether you win by one vote or whether you win over 50% in some cases, that's a big opportunity for John McCain as the national front runner to run up a big delegate total tomorrow and really put this out of reach.
All right. Finally, Mike Huckabee. He has a strong following among social conservatives. At this point, he's kind of considered an also-ran. Is that really accurate? What influence does he have in the race, either, you know, in terms of winning or in terms of endorsing?
Well, first, his dream, of course, tomorrow would be to win big in several states in the South, maybe breakthrough in Georgia, Alabama, his own state of Arkansas, Oklahoma, possibly. He's competitive in West Virginia. We're having conventions, maybe even Tennessee. If he could do that, he could stay in the race as a kind of regional candidate and power broker. Otherwise, the main thing he's doing is he's probably taking votes away from Mitt Romney, which is why Mitt Romney keeps trying to say shoo to Mike Huckabee and get him out of the race if he possibly can.
Well, Ron, thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Farai.
We've been speaking with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, and he joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. But wait, there's more! Politics, of course. We've got Michael Fauntroy and Mark Sawyer. Michael is a professor of public policy at George Mason University. He also wrote the book Republicans and the Black Vote. And Mark is a political science professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. He also directs the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hi, Fry.
So, Mike, the GOP is holding events in 21 states. 8 of those states are winner-take-all. So who's going to benefit from those winner-take-all contests?
Well, you know, something very curious about the winner-take-all states. Some of them became winner-take-all at the lobbying of the Giuliani campaign. And they had the strategy in place that if New York and New Jersey and Connecticut and such went winner-take-all, then they'd be able to lock up the nomination pretty quickly. Instead, it's worked in the exact opposite, and now he's out. And so McCain is now poised to really capitalize on what's going on. You know, there of the top 11 states, he has leads in 10 of the 11, 6 of which are double-digit leads, and many of those are winner-take-all. And with some rough math, it's quite likely that he'll get about 700 or so delegates of the 1,089 delegates that are up for grabs on Tuesday. So he's really well poised to put this really out of reach.
Now, Mark, when you think about, we talked a little bit with Ron Elving about Huckabee's place in the Republican race. When you think about John Edwards having left the Democratic race, who's that going to benefit tomorrow, you think?
It's unclear. Edwards voters have seemingly split in lots of different directions, as well as the Democratic electorate right now just seems to be extraordinarily fluid as people get introduced to Barack Obama, who didn't previously see him before. Independents in a number of these states are able to vote in the Democratic primary, shut out of the Republican primary. And Hillary Clinton had a bad week. She couldn't win a news cycle last week all the way through.
Well, let's move to one specific area. The race has gotten really tight in California, one of those big get states. And Senator Barack Obama received a lot of key endorsements this weekend. Here is one from Maria Shriver.
This is also a moment for California. And the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, if Barack Obama was a state, he'd be California.
All righty. Shriver is a journalist, a member of the Kennedy family, and the wife of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger endorsed Senator John McCain. So how's that for some dinner conversation? When you think about these high power endorsements, Michael, you know, you've got obviously one family offering two completely different cuts. The Kennedy family in and of itself has rolled on with many controversies over who's endorsing who. But these high profile last minute endorsements, do they make a difference?
Historically, they don't, but I would tell you that this election may be a little different. There are so many people, including families, as you mentioned, the Kennedys and their number of others, prominent and otherwise, that are really split on this. And if the elections are going to be so close, a handful of votes one way or another could make the difference in a particular district, which is significant for the Democrats because their delegates are apportioned in terms of who wins a particular congressional district. And if you string together enough of those votes, then it could make the difference in the state. In California, you know, the average of all the polls that have come out over the weekend has Senator Clinton up by about 1 point, but that's negligible and within the margin of error. So anything could happen.
Mark, you're directing the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA. When you look at some of the ways that, for example, I was driving in my car the other day, flipping through the radio stations, and I heard this PAC, Political Action Committee, that had targeted an ad for Barack Obama specifically to young Latinos who didn't vote. It was like a very specific micro ad with a certain kind of language, a certain kind of flavor, a certain kind of music in the background. How are these issues of race and ethnicity playing out in this final push to Super Tuesday?
Oh, well, it's really interesting. I mean, first of all, a lot of people think that there's sort of straight and crass racial voting, and particularly on the part of Latinos. And I really disagree with that. I mean, I think Latinos had a really good name recognition with Clinton, especially older Latinos. But as you see, younger Latinos seem to be energized by the Barack Obama campaign and his appeal to young voters. He had the Yes We Can YouTube video, which I think rose up into the top 10 of YouTube videos this weekend. He's had a reggaeton song and his message of kind of empowerment seems to be targeted. Everyone's trying to find both to sort of motivate the niche group of their voters and try and get out the sort of specific ones. But, you know, it seems to be some of the nasty racial campaigning or the references to that Latinos won't vote for blacks, which they clearly have in the past, et cetera, seems to be waning a little bit and somewhat to Clinton's disadvantage.
Michael, when you look at the vote, how much is, you know, there's so many different ways that things break, gender, race, political affiliation, social conservatism. What trends should we be looking for as we analyze the votes that are going to come in tomorrow?
Well, I think one of the things you want to look for on the Democratic side is what happens with those Edwards voters. You know, many of them are part populist, part experienced traditionalists, and I think that's one of the things that we're going to look very closely for tomorrow. I think another point is, you know, in California, for example, you have a lot of people who have engaged in early voting. And some of those people may have voted before the Obama train really took off in South Carolina. And I'll be curious to see how the early voters break. And so those are the two things I think are most significant from my perspective, in addition to the wider range of subgroups that you just mentioned.
All right, gentlemen, thanks so much.
You're very
welcome. Thank you.
Michael Fauntroy is a professor of public policy at George Mason University. He spoke with us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Mark Sawyer is the director of the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA. He spoke with us from the studios at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, the president unveiled the largest budget proposal in history. The 2009 budget is for $3 trillion in spending. It would increase the defense budget and cause a surge in the federal deficit. For more, we've got Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He also does a finance blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Farai, how you doing?
I'm doing great. So let's talk budget. It would trim health programs such as Medicare, cut funding for after-school programs. How does what's called social spending fare overall?
Fares very poorly. I mean, you see the trimming of many programs that Congress has fought pretty hard for that would help the least among us in this economy and really in any economy. I mean, you look at things like healthcare spending for youth, healthcare spending, overall Medicaid programs. You also look at some things like funding for infrastructure, public housing. All of those things see cuts under the president's proposal. So it would probably harm many people who are least able to help themselves in an economy like this.
Who gets the better side of the bargain? What demographics seem to do well in this budget?
So it seems to be the same demographics that benefited from the president's tax cuts from the very beginning of his term. I mean, we are looking at some things that the president wants to see happen that sort of benefits the upper income, upper tax brackets. The president talks about this being a quote-unquote pro-growth budget, which is something that he said repeatedly throughout his terms when he's pushed for things like his tax cuts, for example. He says, you know, these are pro-growth initiatives. It almost in a loose way harkens back to the era of Reaganomics when you talked about trickle-down economics. If we do things for the wealthy, or if we do things for the business owners, for the entrepreneurs, if we do things for corporations that make it easier for them, then those corporations then spend money, and that increases growth, and that increases jobs, and that increases wages. The problem with that is obviously that over the last several years, we saw many corporations and many of the wealthiest individuals increase their balance sheets, their net worth, and their profits without much of that coming back to the average American.
Now, let's talk a couple of D's, deficits and debts. This budget would throw the deficit into the $400 billion range, up from $162 billion deficits last year. Now, remind us about the difference between a deficit and a debt, first of all.
Well, the deficit is essentially going to be the difference between what the country what the country owes and what the country is bringing in. A debt is just one side of that balance sheet. So the debt is what the country owes. The deficit is going to be the difference between how much in tax revenues that the government is actually bringing in. So the deficit that you're talking about here, when you get up to a $400 billion deficit, you're actually looking at the difference between what the country is bringing in and what the country still needs to pay out, not just for debts to foreign countries, but in terms of all government spending programs.
So it's kind of like overdraft protection. You get your $400 billion overdraft, and that goes into the debt?
Sort of like that, except that in this environment, again, we don't have very much protection against an overdraft. There aren't too many more places that the federal government can raise money from. Some of the Democratic candidates have talked about repealing some of the Bush tax cuts, and you can or extending new tax cuts to the middle class. I don't know that necessarily makes anybody happy in this environment, because there's a equally almost legitimate arguments that could be made for keeping some of the tax cuts in place if you are in the quote unquote pro growth camp that believes that these things are necessary, especially on the corporate side, to keep the economy growing, or if you believe that the middle class needs relief. Where does the government get the money at some point to continue to pay for the spending? And I think that's the real problem. It isn't the deficit and the debt are really symptomatic of the larger problem of government spending, which for the last several years has just been out of control, largely due to what we see in Iraq and Afghanistan. The wars are tremendously costly, and this isn't, by the way, a political judgment of any sort. It's just, you know, we are in a fiscal environment where it just costs a ton of money to keep those wars going, and the country just simply does not have the revenue sources, the federal government doesn't, to keep up with all of the costs and what it needs to do domestically.
So given that you're saying basically the government just can't pay for everything that it is putting out, even though there are certain programs that look like they might be shrunk a bit, what is the deal with all of these Federal Reserve cuts? There's been cut after cut after cut in this prime lending to banks. Is this really going to turn the economy around, you think? Not for those big banks. I'm talking for people who are homeowners, as we talk about so often, or people, even people who aren't homeowners but who are affected by how homeowners fare as well due to city and state taxes. Is this really going to trickle down?
You know, I wrote about this on the blog just last week. There are definitely some people in this environment who it helps. There was a pretty good story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago after the first rate cut that talked about, ironically, the very people who were hurt the most when rates were rising and home prices were very, very high are now benefiting. If you are probably a young person who's never owned a home right now, and it's got a little bit of money saved up in a stable income, you will probably benefit from these rates coming down because they're lower than they've been in about the last 3 years. Home prices are lower than they've been probably at any point in the better part of the last decade. You can go out and make some great deals. You can probably try to trim your rates on your credit cards. I mean, any interest rate right now that's pegged to the federal funds rate, which is a key benchmark rate, that many, many credit cards, many, many some types of mortgages, but also many more types of short-term debts are pegged to, you can benefit a whole lot. The problem is that if you're already in one of these homes, for example, that's in you're underwater, meaning that your house is worth less than the mortgage on it, or you've got poor credit, or you don't have enough money or enough equity in the house to be able to refinance, then you're going to run into a problem and you're not going to benefit. Whether or not that helps the economy overall remains to be seen. I mean, the problem with economic statistics is that many times they lag by a couple of months. And so by the time you find out, by the time a recession is declared, you may have already been in one for about a month or two before the rest of the country actually knows by, you know, some grand proclamation that comes from the Federal Reserve or some economist somewhere that we are in a recession.
We're going to talk a little bit more soon with a realtor in Ohio, your state, about the situation there. But last week, Countrywide Citywide Financial was subpoenaed by the Attorney General of Florida. It's just one of a number of government agencies investigating the largest mortgage lender. So, you know, is this going to be a situation where states line up basically to sue this lender? And what difference would that make in how this is unfolding?
I think it's going to play out in a number of ways. Countrywide is obviously they were the largest non-bank mortgage lender in the country. They were just sold a few weeks ago to Bank of America for what amounted to pennies on the dollar. But Countrywide was by far the largest player in the subprime crisis in terms of a single mortgage lender. But they weren't the only one. The thing is that Countrywide has become a symbol for how bad this got in many communities. And I think if you see a challenge like the one here in Ohio or the one here in Florida proceed with favorable results, you will probably see many other states, especially those where minorities or women or the working class, working poor, were hit hard by subprime mortgages, are going to start lining up, and attorneys general are going to be filing suit against Countrywide and many other companies like Countrywide.
Well, Keith, thanks again.
Thank you.
Keith Reed is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. His finance blog for BET is called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Now, this mortgage crisis has turned people's lives upside down. And last week, President Bush said if folks are at risk of losing their homes, the government should help.
One such action is to help people stay in their homes. We got some of our citizens purchased mortgages that they can't afford now. Hopefully they didn't get deceived. And if they did, the government has a responsibility to take care of that.
Of course, some parts of the country are being hit harder than others. The city of Cleveland, Ohio, is actually suing the mortgage lender Countrywide and 20 other banking entities. The city argues these institutions made loans to folks they knew couldn't pay them back. And with thousands of foreclosures on the books in 2007, some are saying the housing crisis in Cleveland is worse than the devastation caused after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Joining the conversation to help explain what's happening in Cleveland, we've got Danielle Lumpkin. She's a realtor and project manager with the Progressive Urban Real Estate in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So, you know, you've been working in the market for years. What was the market like 4 years ago when you started, and how has it changed?
I think when I started in the market, we were at the lowest of lows in rates, and people were really excited to buy. And so it was a really healthy turning market. Shortly after that, though, we started to see this trend. Like you said, sometimes things lag in the sense that, you know, a trend and with the foreclosures and stuff was brewing up. The market was shifting, and now we're moving into the position where we are now. So when I entered the market, you know, I feel like it was really healthy. We were promoting home ownership at its best. We had so many mortgage companies and brokers out there just lending and people wanting to be homeowners.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what has changed for you. During that heyday, what was a typical day in your life like? And then now, as things are much more shaky, what's a typical day in your life like?
I think in the heyday, we saw there was this healthy balance between supply of houses and the demand for the houses in our market. And what I could typically see is working with a lot of first-time home buyers during that period, people getting really great rates in the 4% for some. And then, you know, in our marketplace, you know, Cleveland's generally a really affordable place to buy a home and a good place for people to obtain. It's homeownership is attainable for a lot of people here because of prices of our homes in our area. You know, today we see those same people losing their homes, and it's just a few short years later, and I think we can attribute it to the products that they were put in, the loan products, and then the kind of responsibility of both the consumer and the mortgage banks.
So, sorry to interrupt you. When you say loan product, you're talking about some of these subprime loans.
Most of the subprime loans. And then just a lot of the creative financing that we saw during that time, which allowed a lot of people to be homeowners and business appeared to be good. And people were buying and becoming homeowners and seeing that American dream. That's exactly what I mean, the subprime product and the creative financing that really plagued during that time.
So when you think about some of your clients who may be in a tight spot and mm-hmm. trying to sell, can you give us a story of someone who's really pressed against the wall?
Well, I think particularly in our market, what we have now is, like other places, we have a major supply of sellers wanting to sell their homes and not a large increase of people wanting to buy. And with our Senate bill that passed last year, trying to combat the predatory lending and the subprime loans as such, that's pushing a lot of people that were buying in years past out of the market. And so particularly what I find is that I have a customer now that had purchased a new construction project in the city. It was part of urban revitalization about 7 years ago. But what happened is we haven't seen any appreciation, real appreciation, in our market since then. It's been steady. I won't say, you know, there's been a decline, but now that the market is so soft and the foreclosures are high, there's a lot of competition out there for my seller, and people are frustrated, wanting to move on with their lives, and they're above their head, you know, up to their ears and debt, and they're ready to walk away from homes. And I've had a seller call me last week and say, you know, I just cannot make another mortgage payment. We've had this house on the market for on and off for 2 years, and what can we do? I'm not going to make another payment. So, you know, people are fed up and ready to walk away from their homes because of it.
So when you say walk away, this person would basically just have to give it up to foreclosure?
Just give it up to foreclosure. And so I think what, you know, only thing we're doing now is we're kind of backpedaling and we're trying to find alternatives where banks are having to work, and they should work with homeowners to try and keep them in their homes. But mostly people feel helpless. They want to just give it back to the bank, do in lieu of or something of the sort, and it just doesn't make any sense that, you know, they continue to own these homes. So there's a feeling of hopelessness. After that point, people are feeling displaced. So
Danielle, let me ask you this. What about you? I mean, you know, it can't be easy for you emotionally or financially to be in this kind of a real estate market, working in this market. How do you keep yourself going?
You know, I feel like there's a social worker side of me when I'm helping sellers try and, you know, salvage their lives, salvage their homes, salvage their credit. I think that's the part of me that kind of keeps me in the business. I can offer my resources and information, and because I feel like it's part of my duty, but it's really hard for me to, you know, stay encouraged. I have, you know, try and continue to earn a living for myself and then also, you know, service my community, service my customers. So it has been a really tough state in the business, and people all over the place are frustrated, professionals, homeowners, and otherwise.
Any advice for someone who's in a position like your client?
I think any advice for any position, don't give up. Try and work with your bank. Contact your local legal aid office. Cleveland has a place called First Call for Help. It's call 211, and that's a program through United Way. You can call and get resources and have someone kind of advocate for you. It is to your best interest to protect your investment and to try and stay in your home. I think my best advice, too, is definitely don't give up. Contact a local realtor and your professionals and you know, try and negotiate terms that will help you maintain until things turn around.
Well, Danielle, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Danielle Lumpkin is a realtor and project manager with Progressive Urban Real Estate. She spoke with us from her office in Cleveland, and we should say that Keith Reed joined us from WGUC in Cincinnati. Next on News and Notes, if the White House gave you $600 to stimulate the economy, what would you do with it? We'll see that on our Bloggers Roundtable next. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Ronald Reagan was the oldest man elected to the presidency. He was 69 when he took office. But Senator John McCain is already 71 years old. If voters ask, is he too old, is that ageism or just a common sense question in the race for the presidency? I'm going to flip those questions and a few more over to our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me now, Ambra Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com. Also, John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John, and Jim Collier. His blog is actingwhite.blogspot.com. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
What's going on, people?
Oh, well, you know, it's big news this week. So let's start out with McCain. The Arizona senator is the GOP frontrunner. And a survey from several months ago found that his age could make things tougher for him. Jim, why don't you tell me a little bit more about the survey and what you think about the issue?
Well, Farai, you know, to help us understand this, Newsweek posted a political poll by Pew Research comparing attitudes towards age versus gender and race. And interestingly enough, what they found is 48% of people were less likely to vote for a candidate in their 70s, while 45% said that age didn't matter. Now, if you jump over to gender, only 11% were less likely to vote based on sex, while a greater 75% said sex didn't matter. And finally, when you back that up on race, a mere 4% said that they were less likely to vote based on race, while 88% said that it didn't matter. And I think this points out, first off, one of the problems with isms, you know, racism, sexism, that all isms are not created equal. For instance, ageism has a large component of objective factors influencing it, versus it also has subjective factors that we need to understand. Versus if you jump over to race is almost completely subjective and has very, very little objective factors. But this sort of gets lost in our polling.
Well, you know, objective versus subjective can also subjectivity, and I'll actually pose this as a question, Ambra, can't these subjective factors rule us just as much as logic? I mean, when you're passing by and you're, you know, going by a shop window, it's like logic may tell you keep your credit card in your wallet, but then your emotions run rampant. So is any of this, there are all these factual bases to the questions, but is that really what you think rules people's minds, or is it more emotions and gut feelings?
I think emotions and gut feelings play a pretty large role. I mean, I don't know if all of you have been following the debates, but I know when you watch the debates and you watch sort of the energy level of McCain, it's quite apparent that, you know, he is significantly older, and it does raise questions in your mind of, is he going to be able to sort of, you know, be fortified in the wake of what could happen in this country?
Now, I'm going to go to you, John. There's another factor, which is health. Much has been made, for example, over the past few years about Vice President Dick Cheney's heart problems. But Senator McCain has had three bouts with melanoma. It's a kind of skin cancer that can be deadly. He appears to have a form that is contained and shouldn't affect him in the future. But what about things like that? You know, the health records have at certain points been used heavily in how people view presidential candidates. Should his health record, should the other candidates' records be taken into account?
No, I mean, what are we asking a man to do, to trial for the NBA? I mean, nobody's asking McCain for two terms. They want somebody to come in right now and fix the current problems that we have. I mean, if it's about health, I mean, Obama smoked cigarettes, right? But nobody's saying that. The only thing we're saying about Obama is that maybe a white racist, you know, will knock him off. You know, nobody's not saying anything about possibly lung cancer killing him. Or, you know, President Bush, he's in great shape, but he still gets hated on. And so the thing about this age thing is that, you know, it's the strange dynamic in that, you know, in this country we're taught that, you know, not to discriminate based on race and gender and age when it comes to stuff like, you know, housing and employment. But it still seems that there is at least one job in this land where you can discriminate based on age and even race and gender, and that's the President of the United States.
I think there's a lot more jobs than that you can discriminate upon those things. But anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. I mean, if it's all about age, then I guess Hillary Clinton wins hands down because Barack Obama is too young and too inexperienced, and John McCain is over the hill. So do we just give the thing to Hillary Clinton?
I guess, really, you know, again, Jim, the question is, when people go into the voting booth, it's also what they say in a poll may not match what they have actually going to go into the voting booth and do. We've seen that time and time again. People may say they're pretty racially enlightened and then walk into the voting booth and have history and baggage with them. Likewise, do you think that this whole age thing could possibly be overhyped, that it polls as a big issue, but people won't really take it into account?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely polls is a big issue, partly because we're just getting older as a society, and we're well kept in terms of the health industry. People are living longer, and like in Cheney's case, they can keep you living longer if you've got an ambulance that follows you everywhere you go. So the reality is that backing all of these sensitivities are voting constituencies that people are trying to appeal to, and that's one of them. I think Bush and Cheney kind of confuse things because Bush is kind of young and Cheney's sort of old, and it's kind of hard to make sort of use of, well, what's the real benefit or challenge here? Because, you know, they sort of kind of rewrote the book on age. I think McCain, you know, he'll, you know, like someone said, he's there for one term. And the question really comes down to, is age a proper surrogate for good mental and good physical health? And so far, the guy presents himself as being pretty good mental and physical health.
All right.
Well, you know,
I actually want to flip us to another political topic, which is going to put you in the driver's seat, and you can certainly go ahead and jump in first. So the president has a plan to fix the economy. The Senate has one. The House has one. There's these potential checks that could go out, $600, $1,200 if you're married. Drop it in the bank, spend it. What would you do if you got your check, your stimulus check? What would you stimulate?
Well, if I got a check, I don't think I would do much to stimulate the economy, because for my money, I would have to tuck that money away. And again, I know that's not going to stimulate the economy, but you got to understand that I drive a 1993 Honda Civic, two-door now. That thing could break down any minute. I need that money on standby to keep myself rolling.
So you're saying that you would probably spend it on car repairs, but not right now. You'd hold on to it.
Yeah, I think I want to sock it away. And again, I know the whole premise behind this thing is to put it into the economy, stimulate some jobs, spend it at the mall, keep that mall manager from, you know, laying off or firing some workers. But, you know, I might have to hold on to it.
Amber,
I think.
Go ahead, Jim.
I'm sorry. I think the point is well taken in that, you know, as an endurance athlete, you know, if I just like take sugar and pour it into my body, I'll get hyped for a second, but then I crash and burn, you know, versus if I look around and thoughtfully, you know, grab a banana, you know, that might sustain me for hours on a ride. And this is the same sort of thing, you know, dumping money in people and then having them run out and do a small short spending spree is just like sugar in the veins.
Ambra, what's your check? Where's your check going, if it even happens?
Well, I think it's a bit of a joke because I think Americans overspend and we're deeply in debt. So, I mean, obviously most people are going to run out. We probably represent the minority here. But I know for me, I'd figure out a way to flip the money and create a profit. So it would either go towards debt or go towards a business acquisition of some sort.
Like what?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I'm an entrepreneur, so I'll figure out a way to turn $600 into $1,200 or whatever the case may be. I'm married, so we'd get double. But whatever the case may be, I'd figure out a way to flip it and not put it towards being consumer, but rather being someone who's creating a profit.
At the same time, though, and, you know, Jim, John, one of you two maybe can weigh in on this, the whole idea of consumer spending is it drives so much of the economy. This check, in some ways, according to economists, is meant to be spent. I guess I'll go to you, John, very briefly.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, will, in fact, this economic stimulus package, is it the panacea? I mean, will it really work out? You know, I wrote a column recently, and, you know, I put forth the idea that maybe we should take some of this money and, you know, put it toward mentoring programs instead of, you know, me spending it on myself. Let me take my check and put it toward a mentor program. But then I pulled back from that and said, well, hey, I'm not going to give my check to mentoring if everybody else is not going to do it. And I think the same thing applies here overall, is everybody going to stick their money into the economy, or are some folks going to hold back?
All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Thanks, guys. We are talking with John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. He was at WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Also, Ambra Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com from KUOW in Seattle. And Jim Collier, his blog is actingwhite.blogspot.com. He was at the studios of the University of California, Berkeley. Few people have known the true story of Abdul Rahman Ibrahim Asori, but a new PBS documentary called Prince Among Slaves could change that. Abdul Rahman was an African prince sold into slavery and brought to America. The documentary chronicles his life and journey back to freedom. Alex Cronemer is executive producer of the film, and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to learn a little bit more about this man. He's recognized as an African prince. Tell us how he first was enslaved.
Well, he was from a country that was larger than the United States of America at the time, and along with other West African countries, was engaged in warfare that led to his capture, and he was then sold to English slavers that sold him on to slavers in the Caribbean and eventually to those folks who were purchasing slaves in Mississippi, and he became enslaved then in Mississippi for 40 years.
How did you find out about this story?
Well, we were exploring the idea of trying to do some documentary on the spiritual life of the enslaved Africans. There's not very much information about what that was all about. Because in addition to the trauma of losing their life, their liberty, their homes, they also lost their religions. So we wanted to understand that better. And just in the course of research, we came across this book written 30 years ago called Prince Among Slaves, and it immediately captivated us. And sort of screamed out to be turned into a documentary film.
Now, Abdul Rahman is Muslim. He read Arabic, which he learned studying in Timbuktu, Mali. Here's a dramatization of him reading.
Show me what you just read.
E'alam ayohalahu alabib.
And where did you learn to read Arabic?
I learned as a boy in Timbu. And Timbuktu.
Alex, how did his faith help navigate him through life in America?
Well, we can only speculate in part because he kept his faith pretty much to himself, in part because in the latter part of his period of enslavement, he was making progress in getting himself and his 9 children who had been born enslaved in America, getting them free. And he was getting a lot of help from a number of Christian missionaries who saw him as a way of evangelizing Africa, that they would send this Christian prince, as what they saw him, back to Africa, and he would bring the heathens, as it were, to the true faith. So when he was asked many times about his religion, he sort of kept that quiet because he knew that to publicly proclaim too much that he was Muslim would maybe hinder his chances of getting his family and himself free.
You have a lot of different talented people who've worked on the film. Rapper and actor Mos Def, who is Muslim, does the voiceover narration. How did you reach out to him?
Well, in some ways, he reached out to us. He learned about the project through one of our directors, Bill Duke, who did the directing of the reenactments for the program. That's how we came into acquaintance with him.
So you do have Bill Duke, well-known director, bringing his talents to these lush reenactment sequences. And then you have someone else, Andrea Kalin. Looking at the documentary side of things, was it hard to marry those two talents and those two approaches together?
Bill and Andrea have worked together on a few other projects. And these two perspectives coming together, I think, made a very dynamic documentary.
Let's go back into Abdul Rahman's story. So he has been brought to America. He has connected with missionaries, but he also attracted the attention of people at the highest echelons of American society.
He became essentially an extraordinarily valuable person to the man who had purchased him. One of the things this story really points out is that we sometimes talk about the unacknowledged debt that America owes enslaved Africans and enslaved African Americans for helping to build America, and that's true. But I think sometimes we put more attention on the physical contributions, you know, the muscle contributions, the sweat contributions. And what this story helps shed light on is there was an extraordinary amount of intellectual capital that was brought to America from Africa that was crucial in the economic development of the United States. And his story in a microcosm shows it, because the person who purchased them was this very poor farmer. And it was Abdurrahman's knowledge of how to cultivate cotton on a large scale that actually allowed this man to escape his own poverty and become one of the wealthiest people in Mississippi at the time. So he was extraordinarily valuable to this man who would never part with him for any reason. As time went forward, this sort of extraordinary event occurred where he met up by accident with a former Irish ship surgeon who had been shipwrecked in Africa and had been saved by Abdurrahman's father. So the one white man in America owed him an enormous debt suddenly was in town. And through a long intervention, his story began to be known at a very national level. And the President of the United States eventually himself, hoping to curry favor with the Emperor of Morocco, because he spoke Arabic, Abdurrahman was mistaken to be Arab and Moroccan rather than African. And so it was the idea that, oh, well, if we get this guy free and back to Morocco, maybe the Emperor will do us a few favors as well. So he was allowed free passage back to Africa, but his wife and children remained enslaved. And that becomes sort of the dramatic third act, because he traveled around America telling his story, and as one observer eventually said, became the most famous African in America at that time.
What do you want to be the footprint of this documentary? How do you want it to echo in the world?
So, but I think most importantly, this is a man who lost everything. And all of us at any time could lose everything. And he, in some way, charts the notion of what it is to be able to hold on to your dignity, to hold on to your hope for the future in spite of great losses, and to be able to remain intact. Because after 40 years of enslavement, he still was completely intact, completely himself, and able to act on his own behalf in very complicated situations to achieve many of his goals. So it's a story of inspiration, I think, for everyone.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Cronemer is executive producer of the new PBS documentary, Prince Among Slaves. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau.